Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Ben Williamson. Dr. Williamson is a Chancellor's Fellow in the Center for Research in Digital Education at the University of Edinburgh in the UK. He's an expert in education technology and data, and is the editor of the Journal of Learning, Media, and Technology, and the author of Big Data in Education, The Digital Future of Learning, Policy, and Practice. Dr. Williamson, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me on, Chris.
So you recently co-authored a report with Dr. Anna Hogan entitled Commercialization and Privatization in and of Education in the Context of COVID-19. As schools continue to be affected by the pandemic, why would you say it's important for researchers and policymakers to be critical of the implementation of education technology in schools?
I think what we've begun to see, not just over the last 6 months of the pandemic period, but over the last few years, is a kind of an extensive reimagining of education according to a kind of vision of what education should or could be like that comes from particular kinds of organizations and from particularly powerful and influential individuals. And this kind of vision of the future of education is captured in ideas like smarter education systems or education disrupted. And my sense is that although there is some sort of more critical education technology research, at the moment there's certainly not a sort of critical mass of this kind of work. So in the broader fields of, say, media studies or critical data studies or digital sociology, there are a number of studies now revealing how digital technology is profoundly reshaping our social, our personal, even our political worlds and our experiences through things like database surveillance and producing new forms of discrimination or is having a kind of overpowered influence on politics. So there's a rich body of work in that vein. But my sense is that education technology is rarely treated as if it's quite so significant in its effects. But my sense is that education technology has potentially huge shaping effects on students' learning experiences or their outcomes. It affects issues of teachers' labor. And it affects or is sort of implicated in questions about the role of public education itself in society. So we've had one recent example in the UK, for example, where we've had a particular algorithmic model used to grade students in the absence of exams. And the outcomes of that have widely been reported as deeply unfair, further disadvantaging already disadvantaged students. So I think that kind of example is beginning to alert the public to the effects of such things as algorithms and digital technologies on education and students. And I think the research really needs to follow up on these kinds of things in much more detail.
So why do you think that research has been slower to look at education technology in a critical way?
I think one reason might be that there is such a strong industry of support for education technology that tends to try and kind of chase off, or in some cases to even silence its critics. There's a really interesting case, concerning case right at the moment with an academic campaigner in Canada who has been campaigning against one of the exam proctoring companies, who is now being sued by that company for sharing particular company details on Twitter. So I think sometimes this education technology industry can be quite aggressive. It's also incredibly well supported by a variety of different kind of tech evangelists or interest groups or by very well funded philanthropies and so on. So it's actually quite a difficult space to make a critical voice heard, I think.
So when you think about the education technology industry, what sort of actors are involved?
Yeah, it's a deceptively complex question. So the edtech industry is really difficult to define or put some kind of sectoral boundary around. I guess I think of it as a kind of multi-sector global industry that includes all sorts of different actors from different sectors. So you have more conventional education businesses such as Pearson, who've diversified away from their textbook model to the development and marketing of digital products. But I'd include alongside them increasingly the global intergovernmental organizations like the OECD and the World Bank, who are now strong promoters of edtech. They see it as a route to improving or even transforming education by boosting outcomes and growing human capital, i.e. skilled labor for the digital economy. And then you've got the international big tech companies such as Google, Microsoft, Amazon. These have now really become market-leading providers of education computers and hardware, of apps, platforms, software, and much larger kind of digital infrastructures on which all of those apps and platforms depend. And you've also got new entrants into the kind of the edtech space like TikTok, which recently announced that it was going to be producing particular educational content, Learn on TikTok. You've got smaller scale technology startups, which are following the kind of Silicon Valley model of expanding products for free or at low cost directly through networks of teachers or even parents. You've got paid for teacher ambassadors who help evangelize for edtech. You've got the market intelligence consultancies that produce market forecasts and stimulate investment. And of course, you've got the investors who fund edtech development and the media channels that promote it. So you've got all of these kind of different organizations, only some of which are actually sort of producing the edtech in the sort of the conventional way that we used to kind of think about the edtech industry. I see it now as this kind of mutating multi-sector kind of global industry that constantly seems to be finding new kind of conduits or new ways of expanding and seeking to demonstrate its impact and effect.
It really is amazing to take a step back and to see how expansive the industry is. As you've began your examination of the industry during the pandemic, how have you noticed that advocates of education technology are trying to frame the immediate response to the pandemic and how education technology can have a role in schools afterwards?
Yeah, so there's both a kind of an immediate short term and a much longer term approach, I think. So in the immediate short term, education technology was framed, including by the OECD and the World Bank, as a kind of technological solution to school closures. And in many ways, that kind of, you know, palliative or sort of curative role clearly had some beneficial effects in terms of ensuring, you know, continuity of schooling without schools. Though it also raises questions about how on earth we got to a position where, during an emergency like the one we've experienced, the only viable source of educational continuity was to turn to the commercial technology sector. But anyway, so there was an immediate short-term kind of approach. But then there's the longer-term way in which the pandemic has been utilized quite explicitly by some organizations as an opportunity or even a great moment, a kind of historical moment for radically reimagining education to be much more technology intensive and data driven, characterized by large scale public-private partnerships to provide poor education services. Here in the UK, government money was spent to ensure that schools had access to Google G Suite or Microsoft Office 365. Worldwide, UNESCO and the World Bank and the OECD helped push G Suite and 365 out to schools internationally too. And then beyond that kind of longer term aim of sort of establishing itself within the kind of infrastructure of schools themselves, if you like, there's been this move to establish and consolidate a new consumer ed tech market, a kind of direct to the student model, to get ed tech into the home, paid for by parents. It's a kind of shadow education industry of private supplementary tutoring, but rather than the kind of tutor being being another human who visits your home and offers private tutoring, it's a kind of a robot or an AI who's providing some kind of personalized support. And there's certainly been a big push and lots of investor interest in this kind of consumer ed tech space. So I see those as kind of two, you know, longer term kind of directions that are being followed. One, the kind of getting big public-private partnerships in school infrastructure, and the other around opening up a new market for consumer ed tech that it's hoped will persist and grow long after we've hopefully recovered from this awful pandemic.
So you mentioned the OECD and the World Bank. How do those organizations help facilitate the expansion of education technology?
Organizations like the OECD and UNESCO and the World Bank, I think, have done a significant amount of kind of framing work of establishing a kind of consensus about the idea that that commercial education technology is the only solution in the absence of schools. And in many respects, you know, of course it was. But what these organizations have, particularly Google and Microsoft, is they have just huge capacity to scale up at speed as online solutions to school closures in ways that other sorts of organizations simply don't. There was some concern in the UK that by turning to Google and Microsoft, the other potential market providers were being squeezed out. That actually there were other, you know, some open source alternatives and other smaller scale education technology organizations which could have also stepped up, but the government turned to these much larger businesses. The World Bank was working directly with national ministries of education, particularly in international development contexts. So it's actually sort of steering and recommending the kinds of digital solutions they might use too. And then we see the quite clever ways in which some of the big tech companies have rebranded or repackaged some of their existing products. So Google's been really interesting because it took the existing G Suite of apps and at first sort of rebranded it as Teach From Home, empowering teachers to be able to continue in their professional and pedagogic capacity, even though they weren't actually in school buildings. And over this summer has sort of repackaged it again as the Anywhere School. So we've now got this sense that as we move towards a longer period of uncertainty, schools may not be able to reopen, but school will persist because it can be anywhere kind of existing on the cloud. And that's quite a careful and clever repackaging, I think, of the conventional G Suite. And let's not forget that Google was reporting by the beginning of April this year that its user numbers for Google Classroom alone had gone from 50 million in March to 100 million by the beginning of April. This was a huge, huge market bonanza for these kind of companies in terms of developing their reach and penetration into schools at scales they simply couldn't have anticipated.
So I imagine all of this takes a lot of money. And you describe two industries, philanthropy and private investment, that have provided a lot of the funding for education technology and its implementation and design and dissemination of research and information. What philanthropic foundations have you found to be particularly involved in education technology, and what sort of activities have they funded?
The dominant philanthropies that we see intervening in education today are primarily those derived from the wealth of elite technology entrepreneurs and the kind of transformative models that they've been promoting. So obviously the Gates Foundation has been funding and promoting education technology for many years. It's been one of the leading advocates for personalized learning and has spent millions in grants supporting that. One of the others that has been particularly active over the last few years is the Chan Zuckerberg initiative, founded from the personal wealth of Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook. And again, CZI has been funding personalized learning programs, including millions to the Summit learning platform. And one of the interesting programs that CZI is currently involved in is called the EdTech Genome Project, which is supposed to be a kind of a source of the DNA of what works in EdTech, a way of assessing its impacts and effects. And then just one other quick example that I think has become increasingly visible in the last year is Schmidt Futures from ex-Google or Alphabet chief executive and chair Eric Schmidt. So that's been strongly promoting the idea of AI-based digital tutors that can adapt and personalize and act as a kind of personal assistant or a personal kind of pedagogic assistant to the student. You know, this really is the kind of robot teacher in your pocket. And Schmidt Futures has also been extensively pushing the idea of learning engineering, a kind of really sort of big data driven version of personalized learning, which draws on all kinds of multimodal data, including sensor information or clickstream data, and compiles all those things together as a way of trying to sort of engineer better ways of teaching or personalizing systems around individuals. And of course, both Gates and Schmidt were called upon by Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York as part of this vision for reimagining education for a post-pandemic sort of new age. Schmidt was talking about, you know, a kind of a vision of kind of tele-everything, including virtual and distance teaching. So these kinds of philanthropies, they're not always, of course, philanthropies. CZI and Schmidt Futures are limited liability companies, so that means they can actually involve themselves in venture capital investment and policy work and influence too. But these kinds of organizations are, I think, really establishing individual private actors who've established themselves through technology wealth as highly influential educational visionaries and influencers who increasingly have reach into and access to networks of finance. They can access the media. They can bring along technology expertise to create or engineer the systems that they think are going to improve education. And of course, they have policy influence too, as we've seen in the way that Andrew Cuomo has drafted them in to help reimagine education in New York. They're really, you know, able to pursue their preferred ideas about the future of education in multiple different ways.
So you mentioned the EdTech Genome Project and Gates and Schmidt's involvement in New York. What sort of claims do these tech evangelists make about what education technology can offer schools?
What they can offer schools, what they claim they can offer schools is in a way school without school or college without the campus. So there's this kind of claim that, you know, we have all these kind of physical infrastructures, and what we've discovered in the last few months is that maybe we can do without them. You know, why is it we have to bus students across cities or in from rural areas into these kind of centralized high schools? So there's this kind of challenge to the idea that the school needs to sort of physically located. Whether that's attractive to the schools in the longer term, I don't know. But one of the other kind of offers is around the long term pursuit of kind of new opportunities for non-traditional students or students who find it difficult to be, or, you know, difficult to include in education systems. So there are significant claims around widening access and tackling inequality. I think one of the other claims is not necessarily for schools, but for parents. So this kind of empowering parents to purchase educational opportunities for their children. A lot of these kind of evangelists have long been supporters of things like charter schools and greater choice in education as well, and the entrance of private providers in a variety of different ways. And I think this kind of direct appeal to parents as sort of purchasers of educational opportunities through EdTech is an extension of that. But clearly, one of the most appealing things for schools themselves is that particularly the bigger technology companies that often these powerful philanthropists come from is that they can offer good value for money. Something like, you know, Google Chromebooks are extremely low cost. G Suite and Classroom are free. So there's a completely different kind of business model for schools here that's completely different to the old kind of or more traditional kind of procurement models, and they can be set up in, you know, no time whatsoever. And also these kind of services or platforms help to streamline certain functions. So where schools are required to report metrics of engagement or performance or achievement or test scores and so on, all of that can be easily streamlined when you have something like a large Google or Microsoft facility running in the background. And what something like G Suite also does, and again, I think this is a clever move by Google, is it integrates together a huge range of third-party platform plugins. So for the teacher or the school that's subscribed to something like G Suite, they're not just getting the kind of core services of G Suite, but they also have access to this much wider market of hundreds of other third-party apps for pretty much everything they need, or everything the teacher needs or the school leader needs or the system admin needs in terms of reporting and so on. But the flip side of that, of course, is that these kind of large scale, you know, we might call them the kind of digital infrastructure of schooling now, they engender a certain dependency on private commercial providers.
So as the pandemic persists, what issues do you think are going to require additional examination?
My sense is that there is a certain public concern around the reproduction of old and the production of new digital divides and forms of inequality. So if the kind of market of consumer ed tech expands as investors and producers currently seem to be hoping that it will, then one of the key issues is around how this might advantage already advantaged and kind of more affluent families and further widen and worsen, you know, existing and historical educational gaps. And I think there's also the concern that there could be a kind of further undermining of the ideals of public or state education, this idea or this assumption that the private sector can solve the problems of education and schooling, and that other kind of forms of public deliberation and more democratic consultations simply can't, you know, find answers to those problems, or that, you know, public workers are unable to solve problems and the private sector can. But the private sector does have its own distinctive ideas and visions about what education should achieve. And if we look at a lot of the examples of the organizations that, you know, we've discussed in this time, we find often they are concerned with economic ideas about future labor demand or the role of education in producing sort of specialized skills for particular kinds of workforces that it said will, you know, be required in a digital economy and so on. And that's a particular kind of vision of what education is for, and it obscures other kind of visions of what education is, or other ideals about education as introducing students to a sort of a plurality of cultures or a range of qualifications to act in one's own life, or to be equipped with the kind of the critical and independent thought to make informed sense of the world.
So given your findings, do you have any recommendations for listeners?
My sense is that teacher unions should be all over this. I mean, that there may be some significant benefits of education technology. And that's fine. And I think, you know, it's important that the benefits are reported and so on. But I also think that education technology does raise some major concerns. It raises concerns that I think are of particular consequence for teacher unions around teachers' professional roles and their labor. What happens when teachers are increasingly, you know, when their roles become increasingly dependent on working with Google or Microsoft tools and so on. There are also issues around student outcomes and these issues of equality that we were just talking about. So I would urge teacher unions to engage with some of the emerging research in this area and seek to devise kind of appropriate responses with their members. And the report I wrote with Anna Hogan for Education International, that's for an international federation of teachers unions, specifically to try and develop, you know, what should be the response to all of this commercial activity in education, and the particularly kind of opportunistic ways in which commercial activity has expanded over the last 6 months.
Thank you, Dr. Williamson. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Torenda White, Dr. White is an assistant professor of sociology and education in the School of Education at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her current research focuses on market-based education reforms in urban communities and its cultural and pedagogical impact on teacher dispositions, teacher professional autonomy and identity, and the development of inclusive classroom practices. In January, we'll be speaking with Dr. Jack Schneider and Jennifer Berkshire, authors of A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. They're also the hosts of the podcast Have You Heard, an excellent podcast that you should check out when you have some extra time. As always, thanks for listening. We hope you're staying safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis of education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.